This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome to Navarra Live. My name is Aaron Bastani, and tonight I have the pleasure for the very first time of being joined by Tadhg Hickey. Tadhg, how are you?
How are you, Aaron? Lovely to kind of meet you properly. How are things?
Very, very good, mate. Very good. Is it sunny where you are?
It's kind of Irish sunny, so like there's an approximation of the sun in the sky, but it's not doing too much damage, you know, so it's nice, it's pleasant.
It's pleasant, that's what we like to hear. Coming up later tonight, the fallout from Natalie Elphick's defection to Labour has exposed rifts for the party. Israel's entry at Eurovision has been met with boos, jeers and chants of Free Palestine. And Rishi Sunak has met with university leaders to discuss anti-Semitism on university campuses. Stay tuned for all of that. First story. US President Joe Biden has finally confirmed what most of the world already knows. Following his government's pause on a shipment of 3,500 bombs to Israel, Biden was asked this on CNN.
I know that you have paused, Mr. President, shipments of 2,000-pound US bombs to Israel due to concern that they could be used in any offensive on Rafah. Have those bombs, those powerful 2,000-pound bombs, been used to kill civilians in Gaza?
Civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of those bombs and other ways in which they go after population centers. And I made it clear that if they go into Rafah, they haven't gone into Rafah yet. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the Middle East recently. But it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used that have been used.
Artillery shells as well.
Yeah, artillery shells.
So just to understand what they're doing right now in Rafah. Is that not going into Rafah as you defined?
No, they haven't gone into the population centers. What they did is right on the border, and it's causing problems with right now in terms of with Egypt, which I've worked very hard to make sure we have a relationship and help. But I've made it clear to Bibi and the War Cabinet, they're not going to get our support if, in fact, they go in these population centers. We're not walking away from Israel's security. We're walking away from Israel's ability to wage war in those areas.
So it's not over your red line yet?
Not yet, but it's we've held up the weapons. We've held up the one shipment as an old shipment designed. We've held that up.
Now, notice that Biden says there quite explicitly that Israeli troops, quote, go after population centers and that civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of bombs supplied by the United States. As Biden says there, Israel has bombed densely populated areas like Khan Yunis, Gaza City, and the Jabalia refugee camp, to name just a few. And the IDF have already used 2,000-pound bombs in many of those areas. That's how we've ended up in a situation where, in just 7 months, 35,000 Palestinians have been killed in the territory, with an unknown quantity of bodies still buried under the rubble. Yet it's only now that the US has decided to withhold some weapons. It's a bizarre situation, one where Biden seems to be saying that it's only now that he sees just how dangerous the Israeli military is when it comes to Palestinian civilians. But it makes you wonder, why didn't Biden see that one city ago, or two cities ago? Why not 5,000 lives ago, or 10? Could it be that Biden just wants a different kind of operation in Rafah? The second thing to pay attention to is Biden's delicate balancing act when it comes to drawing red lines around Rafah. He's very clear that Israel's so-called limited military operation in the city hasn't crossed those lines. But the Israeli government has ordered the forced displacement under shelling and bombardment of 100,000 Palestinians from just 9 neighbourhoods in eastern Rafah. If that isn't a population centre, it's hard to know what is. Is it likely that Israel is going to launch a massive and sudden military operation against Rafah like they did with Gaza City or Khan Yunis? There are a few reasons to think it isn't. Biden has said there are red lines, so it will be in Israel's interests to make those lines as blurry and ambiguous as possible. But that's likely to mean an inch-by-inch operation on Rafah, overwhelming the city so gradually that it'll keep the Americans arguing over whether the invasion has actually happened or not. Sometimes when you give someone a red line, their best strategy is to make it as ambiguous as possible as to whether they've crossed it. And in Biden's case, a bit of ambiguity might serve him politically too. He can tell one half of his Democratic base that he was tough on Israel, while satisfying the other half that he's not interfering with Israel's right to defend itself. Now, Biden's confirmation of Israel's assault on civilian centers comes just a day after the mysterious delay of a State Department report into whether Israel is breaking international humanitarian law in Gaza. Could it be that Biden's relatively straight responses to that reporter's questions tell us something about what more that report might contain? Biden's threat to stop further transfers of bombs and shells to Israel should they move in a more comprehensive way on Rafah has also enraged Israeli officials. After all, conditionality is not something Israel has been used to. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has yet to respond to Biden's comments. But just a few hours after Biden's announcement, this clip of a speech Netanyahu gave earlier this week was reposted on his official Twitter account.
80 years ago, in the Holocaust, the Jewish people were totally defenseless against those who sought our destruction. No nation came to our aid. Today, we again confront enemies bent on our destruction. I say to the leaders of the world, no amount of pressure, no decision by any international forum will stop Israel from defending itself.
Israel's Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, has given his response to Biden's threat of conditions. I say from here to Israel's enemies and its best friends, the state of Israel cannot be subdued. Not the IDF, not the Defense Ministry, not the defense establishment, not the state of Israel. We will stand, we will achieve our goals, we will hit Hamas, we will destroy Hezbollah, and we will bring security. Whatever the cost may be, we will ensure the existence of the State of Israel and remember the promise we made just a week ago during Holocaust Remembrance Day. Never again. For me, this is not just a saying, it is an instruction manual. Even further to the right, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said this: on the eve of our 76th Independence Day, we are reminded that our war of independence is not yet over. We had to do the very announcement of the establishment of the State of Israel despite the strong opposition of Marshall, the Secretary of State in the Truman administration, and despite the arms embargo imposed by the USA on the newly established state. And we must continue this war until victory, despite and to some extent precisely because of the opposition of the Biden administration and the halting of arms shipments. We simply have no other choice that does not endanger our existence and security. National Security Minister Ben-Gavir was more succinct. Hamas, heart, Biden. Tig, what did you make of Biden's comments?
Like, I think the first thing that's just so extraordinary is the comments are so measured. Like, he's, as you say, he says, you know, some munitions are going to be paused, I think, is the way it was reported anyway, certainly. So the first major thing you've got to acknowledge is the entitlement of Zionism. So like, the US is holding up this fascist state. It gives billions in military aid every year. The current genocide going on will stop with one phone call from Biden. You know, the Christian Zionists in the US are fundraising their little hearts away to increase the settlements in the West Bank. Like, Israel is nothing without the US. And the first time in the middle of a genocide that the US puts up even the most paltry hand of pause and says, look, we're going pausing now some of these weapons you're using to kill innocent people if you do this extra thing. And they have a complete and utter hissy fit. It's just extraordinary. It feels like Israel is a spoiled child and the West is his dad. I've no idea where I'm going with this analogy now, just to say. And, you know, the dad was a shit dad, a really, really shit dad before Israel came along, really bad. really bad. And now that he's trying to make it up to him, he spoiled the child and now he's out of control and he doesn't know what to do with him anymore. And that's the way it feels. And this is the kind of hoops that Biden is kind of jumping through and getting himself entangled, because fundamentally he's a Zionist, but his Zionism is now a threat to his political career. It's just extraordinary. The entitlement is the major bang off it. But I think you're right when you assess the fact that Biden is trying to play both sides and the pro-Palestinian movement is getting so strong and has such urgency. The advocates are so articulate, despite the smear campaigns, that he's obviously tailoring his position a little bit. And this is the evidence of that, like as paltry and as pithy as that is, by saying we're pausing some of the weapons you're using for mass murder.
Yeah, you can have the F-35s and the night vision goggles, but you know, just not this one thing. And like you say, they lose the plot. It does make me think, Tig, would they ever go after Americans? I wonder. You know, you saw a settler tweet earlier in the week about David Cameron dying, effectively, going the same way as certain officials that were killed by the Irgun and various Zionist militias in the early 1940s. I mean, like you say, if they don't get their way, they seem to get very angry. This is over such a minute thing. My goodness, what would they do if, and I mean, by the way, the far right of Israeli politics, what would they do if the US, the UK, cut the cord entirely? I mean, they would see us as the enemy, right? We're dealing with fanatics here. The bullish posturing of Israeli officials seems to be translating into action. This footage from the IDF shows a huge buildup of tanks in eastern Rafah, with more Palestinians in the region reporting tanks amassing around built-up areas. Israel's capture of the Rafah crossing has meant that aid entering Gaza has now slowed to a trickle. But a trickle is still too much for some Israelis. Aid trucks are at a complete standstill on the road to the Eretz crossing. That is now the last functional border crossing between Gaza and Israel. And the trucks have ground to a halt because Israeli protesters have blocked the road, expressing their anger that any aid should be reaching Palestinians in the territory at all. A World Health Organization head, Tedros Ghebreyesus, has given this assessment of the situation in the Strip.
We're deeply concerned about Israel's increased military activities in Rafah, where most of Gaza's people have fled for safety. An estimated 30 to 40,000 people have left Rafah for Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah, but more than 1.4 million people remain at risk in Rafah, including 600,000 children. Already, one of Rafah's three hospitals, the Al-Najjar Hospital, has had to shut down and its patients have moved elsewhere. And hospital staff are removing supplies and some equipment to safeguard them. The Rafah crossing from Egypt into Gaza remains closed, which is a major access point for supplies into Gaza. Fuel that we expected to be allowed in today has not been allowed in, meaning we only have enough fuel to run health services in the south for three more days. WHO has pre-positioned some supplies in warehouses and hospitals, but without more aid flowing into Gaza, we cannot sustain our life-saving support to hospitals. WHO calls for removal of all obstacles to the delivery of urgent humanitarian assistance into and across Gaza at the scale that is required.
Tig, what we were just looking at a moment ago with the images struck me as a civilian movement. I say a mass civilian movement because it's clearly lots of people. I'm not suggesting it's the majority of Israelis, but it's a mass movement who effectively want to starve Gaza. If that isn't genocidal in intent, then I don't know what is. But where does that fit in with these broader claims of genocide in Gaza? Is it fair to say that's genocidal in intent? And how does that dovetail with regards to the positioning and the actions of the Israeli government?
Well, I feel like the images that we just saw are just excellent evidence that it's not a few bad eggs. And you can see now in the West a little bit that there's a kind of a maneuvering to try and depict this as Netanyahu's war. And I'm really concerned that we're going to get to the point where there's going to be talk about regime change in Israel being the effective thing to do to stop what's going on. And of course, the problem is Israeli society. I mean, Ilan Pappe and others have written about this extensively. He talked years ago about the way the education system was actually creating the causes and conditions for genocide. The idea of seeing Arabs as subhuman, and they're brought up with this stuff. Like, and again, it's not all Israelis, but let's not kid ourselves either. The idea that there's a kind of a liberal Israel or a liberal Zionism is a contradiction in terms, certainly when it comes to the occupation anyway. Like, you've got people lining up to block humanitarian aid being allowed in to a besieged group of people who you know you're committing mass murder on. Like, all you can argue about is the numbers. You can say the Hamas reported numbers, but you know it's in the thousands, and you're blocking that humanitarian aid in. I would argue that that's a form of psychosis. I believe that, Zionism is a kind of a type of mass psychosis, and it's not a few bad eggs. And as long as we frame it that it's a few bad eggs, then we will delude ourselves into thinking if we just get this government out, then everything will be tickety-boo in the occupied territories in Gaza. And of course, that has never been the case. And there's always been widespread support amongst the Israeli population for these so-called wars. I was reading recently in 2014, during that war on Gaza, the support from Israeli public, I think, was something like 85 or 90%. So it's endemic, it's systemic, it's not a few bad eggs. And I think it really reveals the mainstream support in terms of the government for this war is also supported by the population. And we need to be really, really clear on that.
I suppose I'd come back on you with that point you made about psychosis, Teg. So on the one hand, I agree that Zionism, even quote-unquote liberal Zionism, is completely unlike any liberal nationalism you might see in Europe. It's a very unique settler colonial sort of ultra-nationalism in the 21st century. And in that respect, it's quite unusual. But I suppose if I had a liberal Zionist here, they would say to you, what an outrageous thing to say. I simply want, they might even call themselves a leftist, I simply want the right to self-determination and Israeli state along the borders of 1967, before 1967. Now, I know that's not enough for you. It's not enough for Aaron. It's not enough for some people watching Navarra. I don't care. The Holocaust can't happen again. Those are the arguments that we would hear. But how dare you say that I would somehow consent to people intentionally trying to deprive people under attack from food, energy, water? If that person, that liberal Zionist, that quote-unquote Israeli leftist, was saying that to you, how would you respond to them?
Well, I would say I'm seeing Zionists online constantly attempting to justify or legitimize the fact that their army are committing war crimes. Like, it's as simple as that. We have evidence live streamed on our phones all the time. You guys are doing a great job of it. Al Jazeera are doing a great job of it. We have mass graves being discovered, assassinations, deliberate starvation of the population. So whilst the people actually blocking the aid getting in, they'll get some of the headlines. That looks like the most horrific bunch of them, for sure. But that's not the true picture, because the true picture is that Zionism generally and its defenders, both online and in real life, are happy enough to defend the actions of their army because the greater good is to defeat Hamas. And that seems to be by any means possible. And I think if you're legitimizing or justifying the mass murder of a besieged population and mostly women and children, I feel like you were either a bad person or you were a mad person. And I've tended to think of it as a kind of a type of psychosis. I'm happy enough to say that, and I'm happy enough to take on that liberal Zionist. Should he ever come into existence, please give him my contact details.
I think that's a really fair formulation. And I think when you put it like that, you know, how many ultra-nationalists even in this country or in France, people on the radical right, how many of them would say, actually, you know what, tens of thousands of children being killed is legitimate and they should starve to death soon? Even the worst people on the right of British politics would struggle to say that. But like you said, it's a relatively mainstream opinion in Israel. Next story. Yesterday, Natalie Elphick sensationally crossed the floor, defecting from the Conservatives to the Labour Party. Now, of course, defections happen between parties. That's not new. But Elphick was to the right of Rishi Sunak, let alone Keir Starmer. She was a member of the ERG, the Brexit Spartans, and nominated, wait for it, Liz Truss for Tory leader in 2022. And this morning, Kevin Mills, the Labour leader of Dover District Council, gave his reaction on BBC Radio 5.
I had to check yesterday wasn't the 1st of April when I was told by officers that, have you seen the news? So I knew nothing about it, no understanding it was going to happen. So complete shock and, I have to say, to some degree, horror. Because you know, I have to say Natalie and before that her husband are two MPs that I've had consistent battles with, both as an opposition leader at Dover District Council, as a current leader at Dover District Council, and as a local trade union official. So you know, I was extremely shocked that somebody from what I would say is the right, I think even Rhys Mogg says she's more right-wing than him, has decided to join the Labour Party.
Horror! That's the word he used, horror. She's to the right of Rhys Mogg. To repeat, that is the Labour leader of Dover Council and a trade unionist. That is someone who has had to work with Elphick and previously her husband too on a pretty sustained basis. So, perhaps inevitably, some in Starmer's office are briefing this as merely a concern for the chattering classes of North London, and real people, particularly in Dover, don't care. This is from Alva Ray. She tweeted, "Lotto figure privately dismissive of Labour MP's reaction to the Natalie Elphick defection. It's the Labour Parliamentary Party talking about itself. MPs haven't worked out the leap they're going to have to make from opposition to government." Very dismissive. A few hours later, Alva Ray issued a response to that tweet from the leader's office. A Labour spokesperson said, quote, "This briefing is unauthorised and unacceptable. It does not reflect the view of the Labour Party, including the leader's office." Flame emoji. So in the last 24 hours, we've had Labour MPs brief against the leader's office. We've had the leader's office brief against Labour MPs. And we've had the leader's office brief against the leader's office. Something tells me that wasn't the plan. To underscore how out of touch that Lotto source is, there is this fascinating piece on the BBC website. They, the BBC, visited Dover yesterday to see what Elphick's constituents make of it all. Naturally, of course, local Tory members are incensed. One of them called Elphick a turncoat. But most interesting of all was what regular members of the public had to say. One of them, Simon Parfitt, 57, described the Dover MP as an opportunist who didn't want to lose her job. He told the BBC, quote, "It took me all of about 10 seconds to realise she doesn't want to be part of a sinking ship." I think most people feel the same, to be honest. There were similar responses elsewhere. Diane Holman, a carer from Dover, said she didn't think it was, quote, "that good news for Labour," because Ms. Elphick had not been a brilliant MP. Somebody should tell her she's wrong. She's stupid. She's one of the metropolitan elite because she doesn't think it's good for Labour. She said, quote, "I laughed when I found out, as did my friends. My phone just went ballistic with messages. Everybody just thinks the same." There's one more really interesting quote here. This is from Christine Norman, 80. She agreed with Ms. Holman on the MP's record, describing Elphick as, quote, "very nebulous, very here and there." She added, "it's very much in character and good luck to her. I expect the Labour Party could do without her, to be honest. I love these very subtle pars. Good luck to her." In most cultures, that would be a positive thing, but it's a par in English. It's like not bad, meaning very good. Good luck to her means go screw yourself. Elphick will not be standing in the general election, so she will not be the Labour candidate for the constituency of Dover and Deal. But until then, she will sit on the Labour benches. And she's not been received well by many of her new colleagues. Sienna Rogers, senior writer for The House magazine, said this on BBC Newsnight.
Having spoken to quite a lot of Labour MPs today, there was huge anger and hurt as well. I mean, obviously, from the left of the party, you've got MPs saying, as you would expect them to, things like, well, why isn't Diane Abbott included in the party if Natalie Elphick can be? But then there were also MPs on the front bench, in the middle of the party, very much mainstream, who were kind of raising concerns about previous comments she have made about trade unionism, talking about militant unionism, that sort of thing. That really disturbs them because from whatever wing of the party they're from, they're very, you know, strongly supportive of the trade unions. But also, of course, as Nick mentioned earlier, those comments around Charlie Elphick. So people really talking about how it has the Labour leadership just gone a little bit too far with this particular defection.
But it actually looks very much as if Keir Starmer is very pleased with himself about capturing Natalie Elphick.
Absolutely, the leadership is pleased, and you can see why. I mean, there is a clear short-term political gain. I mean, it very much the headline that most people will see is the government is falling apart, the Conservatives are in chaos, Rishi Sunak isn't holding his party together.
But do you think, and I know that from what Nick was saying, that it is being started by Labour women, and we don't need to go into the detail of that, but do you think a resistance might build a head of steam to this?
I think defections are here today, gone tomorrow a lot of the time in terms of the news. And from speaking to these Labour women who are concerned, they are not going, they're not at the moment planning a sort of collective action like a public letter or anything like that, but they are privately raising their concerns. One of them said to me, actually, this ties in to the reaction they got when they raised their concerns, was tapping into another concern they have that the leadership just isn't very good at managing its relationships with MPs generally in the Parliamentary Labour Party. And that's something they think could get worse after a general election when they have many, many, many more Labour MPs in Parliament.
Meanwhile, Labour MP Jess Phillips had this to say, speaking to ITV's Robert Peston.
I mean, I didn't believe it at first. It was a bit discombobulating. I wasn't actually in the chamber for it when it all happened in what I assume was a very stage-managed way. It was actually a Tory MP who texted me with a question mark, Natalie Elphick question mark. And I was like, what? I didn't know anything about it. So I was a bit shocked. And yeah, I don't think anyone saw it coming.
And then there were the comments of Rosie Duffield, who represents the nearby constituency of Canterbury and was Kent's only Labour MP until yesterday. She claimed to be baffled by the move, telling the BBC this. Natalie Elphick and I work together on a lot of local issues, but I don't believe for a second that she has suddenly transformed into a Labour MP. My stance on immigration, refugees and asylum seekers, for example, has always been completely different to Natalie's. So I'm not sure what that means now about Labour's views on those things. Is it mine or is it hers? It's a very good question. Perhaps most intriguing of all was this response from the founder of Conservative Home website, Tim Montgomery.
I'm probably one of Downing Street's least favourite Conservative commentators. I give Downing Street plenty of aggro. I'm not a great fan of Rishi Sunak. My party's in trouble. Happy to talk about that any day of the week. But actually, I think this defection does say more about John's party and Jenna's party, the Labour Party, because there have been these questions for a long time about Keir Starmer. What does he really believe? The man who served under Jeremy Corbyn, wanted Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister, and you know he's gone through so many evolutions. Mm. And now to welcome someone into the Labour Party who's much more right-wing than I am on immigration and crime and Europe, and I was just appalled, really. And I think the question that will be...
What you were saying was there's more of an issue for Labour.
Yeah.
There's a kind of, you might suggest that there's a kind of sooner handing off now.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think voters are increasingly going to look as we get closer to the election and they're going to say, what are we really going to get if Keir Starmer becomes Prime Minister? Are we going to get the Corbyn iteration? Are we going to get this real centrist? Position. Or are we now going to get someone who workers panders right. to the sort of positions Natalie Elphick says? And the confusion is a problem for you, John. You haven't got definition. No,
elsewhere, an unnamed MP from the Labour left told The Guardian this. I think many in the party think it's disgusting that we don't need people like that in the Labour Party, and that she's absolutely vile. Tell us what you really think. Who in their right mind thought this was helpful? And elsewhere, a shadow minister said this. Logically or politically, we didn't need this. I worry that they'll not have done sufficient due diligence on her. It's all, you don't need to do due diligence. She's been an MP, it's all very public. Her hard right views are a big red line too. Are we welcoming Nigel Farage next week? Well, on that precise question, it turns out that the answer is maybe. Yeah. Adam Bienkov, political editor at the Byline Times, reports this. Asked if Keir Starmer would also welcome Nigel Farage into the Labour Party, his spokesman replies that, quote, we have conversations with all sorts of people who want to come and support the party. Was a simple no so difficult there? But then maybe that wouldn't have been the answer, given Elphick and Farage have virtually indistinguishable politics. That comment was later put to former Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell.
Apparently, a Labour spokesman was asked after Prime Minister's questions today whether the Labour Party would take Nigel Farage in and couldn't give a straightforward no.
You're joking.
I'm just telling you what I've been told.
Is that right? Well, I don't know who that Labour spokesperson was, but they need a proper briefing on what Labour history is and what our Labour values are. And we're certainly not supporting and allowing into the party, I think, the likes of Nigel Farage, who has been nothing but, as far as I'm concerned, one of the major causes of division within our society.
I think that's fair. And what does it say about the Labour Party that Nigel Farage might be able to join, in the words of a Labour Party spokesperson, but Jamie Driscoll can't stand for re-election because, as Johnny Reynolds insinuates on television, he's too extreme. One figure who has been seemingly designated with defending the Elphick decision is Annalise Dodds. She was confronted by Ed Balls on GMB this morning.
How do you explain this to Labour Party members, to voters in the country, that somebody who attacked Marcus Rashford when he was campaigning on food poverty amongst children, who defended her husband even though he was convicted of a sexual crime, who has attacked Labour's open borders policy. She's now a Labour Member of Parliament in the House of Commons, and Diane Abbott, the longest-serving black Member of Parliament who is a woman in our country's history, is currently not a Labour MP in the House of Commons because you are keeping her out of the party. How come Nanti Elphick is an acceptable face for Labour in the House of Commons and Diane Abbott is an unacceptable face?
Well, Natalie Elphick rightly apologised for those comments about Marcus Rashford, which were unacceptable.
So did
Diane
Abbott.
There was, if I may finish, there was a parliamentary process, quite rightly, and the sexual assault conviction was, of course, an extremely serious one, and there's no place for sexual harassment or assault in Parliament or anywhere else. And that was clear, ultimately, in that parliamentary process, which was then applied to Natalie Elphick. Mm. When it comes to Diane Abbott, obviously, Diane was a trailblazer for the Labour Party, an incredibly important figure. There is an independent complaints process that applies to complaints in the Labour Party.
It's been going on for a year.
I'm not going to comment. Well, that's because it's critical that there is a robust process that applies in the same way to everyone.
You can just imagine the briefing from the Labour Party press office, from the leader's office. You have to remember, Annalise Dodds, trailblazer, respect, independent disciplinary process. By the way, we know there isn't an independent disciplinary process because Keir Starmer was the person who pushed the case with regards to Jeremy Corbyn, with him losing the whip in response to the HRC announcement. Starmer has overtly said, I made that decision. That's why I'm a good leader. You can't on the one hand say that and on the other hand say, sorry, it's taken a year, but we have independent disciplinary processes. By the way, this is the exact same Labour Party that says, with regards to the asylum seeker backlog in this country, oh, we're gonna process people's cases in 6 months. So it's going to take you 6 months to process someone's case from Afghanistan or from Libya or from wherever. That'll take 6 months. But to discern whether or not Diane Abbott should be allowed back in the parliamentary Labour Party takes a year plus. Please. It does seem that grumbling from Labour MPs has had some impact, however, because earlier on today, Natalie Elphick made a statement which included this. The period of 2017 to 2020 was an incredibly stressful and difficult one for me, as I learned more about the person I thought I knew. She means her husband. I know it was far harder for the women who had to relive their experiences and give evidence against him. I have previously, and do, condemn his behaviour towards other women and towards me. It was right that he was prosecuted, and I'm sorry for the comments that I made about his victims. Interesting that you're saying that after you've joined the Labour Party. It's almost as if somebody's written it for you. No mention there, by the way, of championing the Rwanda policy until last week, or previously saying that Starmer is a softie and that Labour wants open borders. Do they still want open borders? And if they do, do you? But does any of this really matter? Because in terms of national polling, individuals within the leader's office clearly think not. And in the short term, I suspect they're probably right. After all, take a look at the latest YouGov polling published this morning. It gives the Labour Party a 30-point lead over the Tories, their largest poll lead in recent history. Labour are not on 30, they're 30 ahead. That poll puts Labour on 48%. And if this poll is to be believed, that would give them a larger vote share than the Tories, Reform, Lib Dems and Greens all put together. Now, the data for this was collected before the Elphick story broke, but it would be pointed to as evidence by Starmer's team that they know what they're doing. But for my money, the issue with Elphick is less about an instant response in the polls, for better or worse, and more about how Starmer will actually govern, what he believes in, and how he plans to manage his party. Because he can't just dismiss all those metro mayors, MPs, devolved leaders and councils when he's in number 10. Lastly, on this story, Commons leader and fellow Tory Penny Mordaunt was reportedly shocked when Elphick crossed the floor before PMQs. Mordaunt was who Elphick originally backed for Tory leader in 2022 before she was eliminated and ultimately went on to nominate Liz Truss. Here's what Penny Mordaunt had to say in the Commons today in reference to Elphick's defection.
Well, first of all, can I reassure the Honourable Gentleman that I am not about to defect to the opposition benches. They wouldn't be interested in me. I'm too left-wing.
Embarrassing. Absurd. Possibly true. Possibly true. Maybe she is too left-wing. And I suspect, you know, she looked very impressive with that sword. Keir Starmer might have some sense of inadequacy. Oh no, she might be a leadership challenger. Don't let her in. Next story. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has held a roundtable meeting in Downing Street with university heads and Jewish student groups. The subject? Pro-Palestinian demonstrations at British universities, of course. I say of course, not because these protests, which have been incredibly peaceful and well-ordered, require the Prime Minister's attention, but rather because they're bound up in the latest moral panic imported from the US. The Tories love those. It gives Sunak a shot at a strong-sounding headline while demonising peaceful protesters. Education Secretary Gillian Keegan appeared on Sky News and gave us a taste of just how flimsy the pretext for that meeting was.
Is there a fear of things in the US being replicated here?
There's always a fear of that. You know, there's always a contagion fear. And obviously, you know, there are some groups that, you know, are encouraging this as well. So there is always that fear. And what we want to do is make sure, no, absolutely not. Our universities, our campuses, they obviously are places where you debate, where you share views. You don't obviously have to agree, but they have to be respectful. And they certainly have to be respectful and safe places for all students.
Which groups are encouraging it?
Well, there's all kinds of different rumours around different groups. But the reality is there are people who are, talking to various students. I'm sure there's people from the US. There's reports from the press. So all I've heard is reports from the press that there's groups in the US that are talking to students here.
Rumours, reports in the press. You're an MP. You're representing the government. We need to be worried because there's reports in the press and rumours. I don't know. We better get the PM involved. Pronto. There's stuff in the press. But Sunak did get his headlines in the end. This is how the Daily Mail reported the event. Rishi Sunak tells university bosses to show, quote, zero tolerance towards anti-Semitism amid fear of violent copycat Gaza protests like those that have blighted US campuses. Violent copycat. And she said contagion. Gillian Keegan. Contagion. I'll tell you what's contagious. The far-right Zionist whack jobs who have massively inflected the conversation in the United States in regards to Israeli actions, that's contagious. It's been coming over here. And it's been adopted wholesale by many conservative MPs. Now, there were no violent Gaza protests on US campuses. Instead, there were violent administrators and violent police and violent far-right and pro-Israel counter-protesters. But that doesn't fit the brewing narrative. Now, while no representatives from the group supporting Palestine were invited to that meeting, Union of Jewish Students Vice President Edward Isaacs gave a speech. In it, he said this: "While we respect the right to protest, it is important to recognize campus relations will only be improved when university leaders are clear with students on red lines. For example, the call to globalize the Intifada is not a meaningless political statement. It is a direct call to spread the sort of violence seen in Israel in the late 1990s and early 2000s, which saw random acts of terror against civilians at innocuous locations. Universities have to make this red line clear." Isaacs is right. The call to globalize Intifada isn't meaningless. That's why students are using it. What the slogan advocates is global activism in support of Palestinian resistance. And guess what? Most of the globe already supports Palestinian resistance. They don't need students calling for it. "Oh, the students have said we should do it, so we have to do it." No, people can think for themselves. So in its context, it's really just a call for the West to wake up and protect the inalienable rights of Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. But I think Isaacs probably already knows that. In his speech, he went on to say this: "The vast majority of Jewish students identify as Zionist, and other students must recognize that a Jewish student can be a proud Zionist while also deeply caring about Palestinian human rights. The understanding of this nuance should also be taken when looking at Jewish students in encampments. Students are entitled to their right to protest, but their presence there should not be seen as representative, and it should be understood that their presence in these encampments does not legitimize the harmful language being used." I love these statements and these speeches. It's like you need a PhD in sociology to even have an opinion. You know, everybody's, and that's the point, by the way. Everybody's terrified. Nobody likes to be called a racist or anti-Semite. Well, I don't have a PhD in semiotics. Maybe I can't have a view on this. Can a person be a proud Zionist and care about Palestinian human rights? Quite possibly. But can they be a proud Zionist and care about the other rights of Palestinians, namely the right to self-determination, to a national identity, and crucially, to territory? All of the evidence says no. But it's the presence of anti-Zionist Jewish people in the encampments that really seems to grate. And that's because their very existence there undermines the intentional conflation, I think, of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. To the question of whether the protests are anti-Semitic, Ben Jamal of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign told GMB this:
"It's a movement that will stand against all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism. Students will say there is no place in their numbers for people who do not share these fundamental anti-racist principles. But what's going on here, as we have seen time and time again, is the conflation of anti-Semitism with legitimate criticism of Israel's actions."
Tig, I find this really, really interesting. 35,000 people have died. We're looking at war crimes, collective punishment. We've seen diplomatic presence been blown up. We've seen, really, actually, Israel and Iran on the brink of war. Mm. And a student who is the UGS president has gone to 10 Downing Street, has had the ear of the British Prime Minister, and they're talking about nuance. What does it all mean?
Jeez, that's a big question. Yeah. I kind of feel like the use of contagion, which you picked up on, was very interesting as well. It feels like they're kind of treating it like a little bit like COVID, that it started in America and Rishi Sunak wishes to inoculate himself from the spread to Britain by hammering down on an anti-Semitism thing, which, let's be honest, in terms of the pro-Palestine movement in the US on campuses being intrinsically anti-Semitic or even being blighted by anti-Semitism is a myth. It's a fiction. It's a made-up story. The real contagion, I think, that they fear is knowledge. So these students are brilliantly articulate. They totally, again, despite the smear campaigns, they totally know what they're saying. And they're shedding light on Western complicity in the mass murder being committed in Gaza right now. And the corporatists and the elitists don't like it. And that's the contagion that they're desperate not to spread. I also think as well, I'm not an expert on British politics, but it reminds me a little bit of Ireland, that I think, and it would also be classic Tory that they're kind of pandering to the right and trying to pick up some of those kind of real extreme right-wing votes by kind of positioning pro-Palestinianism as part of this culture war, and that they're all kind of woke hippies and, you know, Rishi Sunak represents good old-fashioned Britain where men were men and women were women and Churchill was brilliant. You know, I think it's just a man running out of ideas. Obviously, his party's falling apart, as you've just shown by the recent polls. And he's just falling in line with, I suppose, the right-wing elements of the Republican Party in the US, most of the Republican Party, which, again, they're so scared of. And of course they are. Student movements have traditionally been proven throughout history to be massively effective. You know, South Africa, unfortunately, didn't work with the Iraq war, but it was a massive movement. Vietnam. So they're so scared of their corporatist interests being dissolved and the connection to Zionism and its mass murder and its brutality being brought back to the door in the US and Britain. And they're willing to do anything to try and obfuscate. And I think a big part of that is to try and paint, as Netanyahu did, these like really well-educated, wonderful students as somehow a kind of a baying mob of neo-Nazis. And if you buy that, you'll buy anything.
Yeah, that's so well put. I mean, we saw quite recently footage of somebody, a Jewish American woman, going into the middle of a protest, a pro-Palestine protest, and saying, I'm here, look at me, trying to get attention, trying to wind people up. Didn't work. And I think that really underscored how peaceful these protests are. And very quickly, I do find it very amusing that this chap, Edward Isaac, said, I believe in the right to protest, but we have red lines. But you're making it conditional then, right? And of course, there are conditions. Incitement is bad. But globalize the intifada. I find it strange. I mean, people maybe watching or listening might disagree. On the one hand, you've got tens of thousands of people being killed, war crimes. And then people are getting upset about from the river to the sea, globalizing intifada. They're just words. This is why I want a constitutional, codified right to free speech. So when people say this stuff, you said globalizing intifada. Don't care. It's my right. Shut up. They have that in the US. And look, it's not often I compliment the United States, but in that regard, it's something we could imitate over here. The next story. One of the primary lines of attack against Jeremy Corbyn during his time as Labour leader was the claim he was anti-Semitic or that he was too weak on the issue of anti-Semitism within his party. That isn't to say there weren't incidents of anti-Semitism. It would be outlandish to say anything like that, given there were about 500,000 members in the Labour Party at its largest, I think actually about 600,000. But we do know that malicious actors, like a non-Jewish man who signed his emails, David Gornstein, sent industrial numbers of complaints to make the party's disciplinary systems unworkable. There was, and this is beyond doubt, among certain actors, a sustained effort to use the issue to remove Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party. And worst of all, Labour members were five times more likely to be investigated for anti-Semitism if they were themselves Jewish. Now is the turn of the Green Party for such treatment. And that's because the Jewish Labour movement and affiliated society within the Labour Party have called the Greens out for their failure to stamp out anti-Semitism. This is a tweet from the JLM, the Jewish Labour Movement. The Green Party have repeatedly failed to take action to stamp out anti-Semitism in their party and to remove anti-Semites from their ranks. We first warned the Green Party about this last year. Sadly, we've had to write again. There's nothing progressive about protecting racists. I would say precisely that about Benjamin Netanyahu. And now the contents of that letter were typically passive-aggressive for Labour Party politics. I like to call it cry-bullying. You cry about how defeated and how oppressed you are while bullying somebody else. But of particular interest were the final few paragraphs. Here they are. It also seems that Councillor Ali, as a person in question earlier on in the letter, was a Labour Party member under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. This follows a pattern we first identified when we wrote to you last year of the Greens accepting the membership of those who had either left or been expelled from Labour without asking why. In our letter to you last year, we wrote the following, quote, "We fear that the Green Party is in danger of providing a refuge for both the ideas of left-wing anti-Semitism and the individuals involved in the bastardization of progressive values that we all share." So hold on, let me get this straight. Before we go on, let's just stick with this for a moment. You need to explain why you're accepting people who've left the Labour Party into the Greens. This is the same day Labour accepts a Tory MP who's to the right of Jacob Rees-Mogg. Anyway, going on. Rather than heeding this warning, it seems that you have doubled down. It isn't good for progressive politics or for the Jewish community when those who are unable to advocate for the Palestinian cause in a non-anti-Semitic way are given the endorsement of your party and are allowed to stand for office and serve under your party's banner. We think Jewish people, not least those in the wars councillors Makawi, Malik and Ali represent, deserve an answer to our questions. Perhaps this time you'll do them the courtesy of providing a meaningful response. We will finish by repeating our request to you for an explanation of how the Green Party is training its elected representatives and activists on understanding and countering left anti-Semitism. For the sake of fighting racism and promoting equality and tolerance for all minority communities in our country, please don't ignore our letter this time. Unreal. Please don't ignore this letter. Why not? Why can't they? You're not the police. You're not the Inland Revenue. You're not the local council or debt collection agency or a court. You're an interest group, literally, within a rival political party. Of course they can ignore you. Of course they can. And I love this thing about the emphasis on training. What training do you have? This is anti-racism now for the professional managerial class in the 21st century. What training do you have? And maybe there's a training they can sell to the Greens. Who knows? And it was precisely on this point that Zach Polanski, deputy leader of the Green Party, had this to say. Does anyone else find it bizarre that a group within the Labour Party, of which you don't need to be Jewish to be a member, are writing letters to the Green Party? In the exact same hour, they just accepted a right-wing Tory as an MP. Anyone might think it was a distraction. They might do. Now, before JLM calls Mr. Polanski anti-Semitic, they should know he's Jewish. Although, of course, given Jewish Labour members are five times more likely to be investigated for anti-Semitism than non-Jewish ones, that probably makes Mr. Polanski a marked man. That said, it seems that there are some immediate benefits to standing your ground, with Polanski tweeting this the very next day. "Gonna thank the Labour attacks of the last few days for increasing our membership considerably. If you'd like to join the party, that is the Green Party, for environmental, social, racial and economic justice, join greenparty.org.uk. If only I was as good in telling people to support Navarra Media. Here's my view on this. The exact same playbook used against Corbyn is about to be used against the Green Party of England and Wales, especially given they are competitive in not just Brighton Pavilion, but Bristol Central too. They now have more than 800 councillors across the country, and while they aren't a threat to Labour for the next general election, a party to Labour's left will clearly be something they feel they need to address in the coming years. And the anti-Semitism line is useful against the Greens for the precise same reason it worked against Corbyn. Firstly, the Greens present themselves as morally virtuous people, and associations with racism, true or not, undermine that. Secondly, expect the claims to come not from Labour itself, that would be beneath them, but initially at least, organisations like the JLM, Labour Friends of Israel, Hope Not Hate, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, and the Board of Deputies. Hope Not Hate is impartial. It's an NGO, I hear you say. Well, I wouldn't be so sure, given one of its trustees is literally a member of the Labour Party National Executive Committee, Gurinder Jozan, and another is former Labour MP, Anna Turley. Meanwhile, Simon Tuttle has donated money to Lisa Nandy MP, and Baroness Ruth Smeath, formerly a Labour MP, is a, wait for it, company director. So expect organisations like Hope Not Hate and LFI to make the running here. They will do so using a drip, drip, drip of bad stories and negative PR. And believe me, I know how it works. They used all of those tools against me. Next story. This year's Eurovision Song Contest is being held in Malmö, Sweden. Unfortunately for Israel's representative in the competition, it also happens to be one of the most left-wing cities on Earth. Which is why during Edan Golan's performance of her song Hurricane in the show's dress rehearsal on Wednesday, this happened. If you weren't clear about that noise, that was booze, okay? That wasn't well received. As Golan left the stage, there were calls of Free Palestine and From the River to the Sea. Now, Malmö has been, and by the way, that is how you pronounce it, has been the site of several large-scale pro-Palestine protests in the run-up to Saturday's Eurovision. That's after widespread calls for Israel to be booted from the contest over the country's war on Gaza. But Eurovision itself appears to have taken a stance on Palestine. Bambi Thug is Ireland's entry in the competition. They explained to RT Radio 1 why they had to remove a message written on their body as part of their stage makeup.
Talk to me a little bit about the Om writing on your face. What happened there?
Yeah, so, I mean, I was devastated that I had to take it off. But I wasn't going to be allowed on stage if I hadn't. And unfortunately, you know, there's a bigger picture here. I have to do the performance to be able to make any impact anywhere. Yeah.
And what did it say?
Originally, it said "Sir Shadun Palestine" and it said "Ceasefire."
Okay, right.
So I had to change it to "Crown the Witch."
I would be very reluctant to be heavily critical of individual artists because I feel like the broadcasters should have stepped in a long time ago, particularly Ireland, when it shows so much solidarity with Palestine anyway. We're an outlier in Europe anyway. Our national broadcaster here are weak. They have many internal problems. They largely report IDF talking points. So there's a massive difference between the media and the political class in Ireland and the people on the street. Here, if we had a stronger broadcaster, I think we could have easily pulled out of the competition. It would have been shocking and whatnot. But at the end of the day, like, it's a singing competition, and they've included a country in the singing competition from the Middle East, by the way, that's on trial right now for genocide. I think it's absurd. It's almost absurdly humorous that they're in there at all. But what I would say about the artists, the broadcasters didn't step in, and then you've got an opportunity, the English entry, or the British entry, sorry, and the Irish entry, I'm thinking of specifically, you do have an opportunity to make a stand yourself. I mean, nobody's going to really force you to sing, I don't think. And I feel like writing messages on your face and wearing keffiyehs and all that kind of stuff, it's almost a little bit insulting, because certainly the pro-Palestine movements here in Ireland, and I know around the world, they've been quite clear, you need to listen to Palestinians. And Palestinians are quite clear that any institution whatsoever, like the Eurovision, that's attempting to kind of overlook the genocide and create a distraction from it and try to rehabilitate the genocider's image, if you will, they are asking us to boycott. So don't cross the picket line, even if you're going to make some facile gesture when you do so, I think, you know. Even the people, and I could be way off here, but even the people in the stadium booing and hissing and whatnot, why not just boycott? Just boycott the event as Palestinians have asked us to do. And I think the idea of, I know people have said, look, we'll do the competition because we're going to unify the world through music. Like, with the greatest of respect to them, I think a child or an adult in Gaza at the moment doesn't want to hear the idea that you think that you're going to unify the world and create peace by singing your song in the Eurovision. Come on, like, give us a bit of, you know, give us a bit of respect.
I think that's really well put, Tig. I suppose I'd have a question for you, though, which is, firstly, I agree. I mean, Israel shouldn't be there. And that's not an outlandish position, particularly because Russia was banned from participating for very similar reasons, right? It was involved in a conflict. It had broken international law and whatnot. So there's a very recent precedent, very easy to do. I suppose what somebody could say to you about the people that are going there and booing the Israeli act, they would say that we're putting a magnifying glass on what's going on. That garners more attention. And actually, that's more effective than nobody who's critical of Israel attending and then performing and sort of nobody really making it a story. I feel there is an argument. I don't agree with it, but I do feel there's an argument that actually people there jeering, booing an Israeli act at one of the biggest television events across Europe probably has something of an impact. I mean, I feel like that breaks through to tens, hundreds of millions of quote-unquote normies. By the way, the story already has, but I do think it breaks through to very, very, very many people in a way that maybe a boycott in this instance wouldn't do. That's not to say I agree with it, but I think there's an argument there. What's your take on that?
That's a very fair point, to be honest. And that's why I said at the start, look, I'm not sure what I'm talking about when it comes to the local Palestine, pro-Palestine movement in Malmö. And if they've decided that it's more effective to go in there and boo, that's all very well. But if it was like random people who aren't part of a collective effort in support of Palestine going to the Eurovision and throwing in a little boo to make themselves feel better about themselves, yet they've still crossed the picket line. I suppose that's what I was getting at. But yeah, I mean, I know in the Irish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, we were very clear and, you know, we were urging Bambi Thug to definitely boycott. I mean, my own personal view is if you had the balls to boycott, I think it would actually be a real injection into your career prospects, because the swell of support in Ireland for artists who are boycotting is immense. Well, I totally take your point. And if that group over there, that pro-Palestine group over there, feel the best thing to do is to get in there and make some noise, if it's effective, whatever is pro-Palestine right now, and by pro-Palestine, I just mean anti-genocide at this point, whatever is highlighting the war crimes and whatever can edge us closer to not just a ceasefire, but justice, statehood for Palestine, then that's a good thing. And I leave each group and each individual city to decide what works best for them. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I like the emphasis you've got there on collective action. I think that's a nice way to think about things, rather than atomizing it to the individual level. And just finally, I mean, it is very funny. This is in Malmö, which is arguably the most radical city in Western Europe. You know, it's the home of the Swedish Kurdish community. I think it's administered. The local government is by the Vänsterpartiet, which is the left party, which was the party that was historically connected to the USSR. It's really left wing, okay? Even by Swedish standards. And I think they're in charge of Malmö. So yes, rather amusing that that's the location for this year's Eurovision. And I think it's a very good thing, because it's going to highlight one way or another whatever tactics people are pursuing. What's going on in Gaza to a very, very large audience. Tadhg, thanks for joining me this evening.
Absolute pleasure. Talk to you next time, buddy.
Yeah, it was really fun. And thanks everyone for watching this evening. Come back tomorrow for another stream. For now, you've been watching Novara Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Novara Media. Go to novaramedia.com/support.